This is Whitley Strieber, and this is Dreamland. You've reached the edge of the world.
We've got a great midsummer show for you today, folks. First, Andrew Collins is going to be talking about those extraordinary shafts that have been found near Stonehenge, 15 meters deep, huge shafts, and hundreds of them. But why? What are they there for? If anyone can enlighten us about something like this, it's Andrew Collins. He's been on Dreamland more than 10 times over the years, most recently last September for Denisovian Origins. He and Greg Little talked to us about the Denisovians, who were a pre-hominid species with some extraordinary characteristics that still remain very mysterious. Prior to that, we explored Göbekli Tepe with him, and it was an absolutely amazing show because he's been there, and not only been there, he understands it deeply. One of the all-time classic dreamlands on the Cygnus mystery is with Andrew. So you can expect a great half hour with Andrew. Then we're going to be talking to David Halperin. David and I have been friends for years. David does not agree about UFOs. He has a very different take on them than I do. He's not a believer. He's not even a very religious, in fact, at all religious. He's pretty much, I think, of an atheist and a UFO, not a skeptic, though. His take is really fascinating. So it'll be a fascinating show exploring UFOs from a very different perspective with David Halperin. We've got a great experience for you today, no question about that. But first, without further ado, except to say Andrew Collins' website is andrewcollins.com, let's welcome Andrew to Dreamland. And Andrew, can you tell us a little bit more about these shafts?
Yes, I can. They're called Durrington Shafts. That's the official name that they've been given. And they consist of a roughly circular pattern of enormous pits that are around 10 meters in width, which is about 33 feet, by about 5 meters in depth. So that's obviously around 17 feet in depth. And so far they've detected as many as 20 of these. They think that there was originally around 50. And they believe that they can probably find another 10. Urban development has unfortunately got in the way of some of the areas where they are located. And they encircle a pre-existing Neolithic earthen henge monument of huge size called Durrington Walls. And there is a complete relationship between Durrington Walls and Stonehenge, which is about 2 miles away. It is believed that in the past, huge feasts would take place at Durrington Walls around the time of midwinter, so that's the winter solstice, that in current calendars is December 21st, and that people would gather there from all over Britain, and they would feast on cattle and pigs, deer and other animals. And then at some point during the night before the winter solstice, they would then travel along the length of the banks of a river there called the River Avon, and they would reach just a couple of miles away, or in fact even less, a point on the banks that joined what's known as the Avebury Avenue. And this is like an earthwork avenue that takes you all the way to Stonehenge itself. And that there, at the moment of the sunrise on the shortest day, they would celebrate the ancestors, because it is believed by archaeologists such as Mike Parker Pearson, who's been heavily involved with the projects around Stonehenge for the last 20 years, that Stonehenge represents a place of the dead, whereas Durrington, in his opinion, is a place of the living. In other words, it's a place that the living would celebrate and have their feasts, and that, you know, they would then go off to Stonehenge, where they would contact or communicate with the ancestors. And I think that it's important to point out that this whole area is what they call a ritual or ceremonial landscape. There are dozens, if not hundreds, of ancient monuments within a 10-mile radius of Stonehenge. You have long barrows constructed around 5,500 years ago, which were for the interment of the dead and also for ritual practices involving the ancestors. You've obviously got stone circles like Stonehenge itself. You have all sorts of earthworks, everything from circular henges to long linear cursus, as they're called, or avenues. And you have many round barrows and other types of structure in this area, the functions of which are very difficult to understand in modern day terms. So the question becomes, who was doing all of this? Well, it would seem that around 2800, when for the most part this circle of shafts was put down, even though there's some evidence that some of the shafts may even be older than this time, there were three different types of people in the area. One would have been the indigenous local people who would seem to have been associated with the long barrows and had been for, you know, millennia, and that they would have looked after duties to do with the dead. And there's some evidence that they may well have been a female-oriented cult associated with the moon. My colleague Maria Wheatley has done quite a lot of work on this and has published on these subjects. But then there was another culture coming in from the north, who we call the Grooveware culture. And they're named after a very distinctive type of pottery that they carried the tradition of how to make. And they were very beautifully decorated and very diagnostic in the fact that you can identify them whenever a fragment is found. And these people would seem to have come from the north as far away as the Orkney Islands, which are situated off the north coast of Scotland. This is where the Grooveware culture began around 3000 BC, and they gradually spread southwards, creating different ritual or ceremonial complexes, of which Stonehenge and Durrington is one. Another is the place you've already mentioned, and that's Avebury and Silbury Hill. They created monuments there. But they were also in other parts of the country. They were in Wales, they were in Yorkshire, and it would seem as if they also got across to Ireland and were instrumental in the creation of the Boyne Valley culture over there, with places like Newgrange, Nulth and Douth, the two other great passage graves over there constructed about 3000 BC. And then there was a third influence coming to bear on things in the Stonehenge area, and they were the Beaker people. Now, these were inbound from the area of the Iberian Peninsula, what is today Spain and Portugal. And they were carrying the very earliest forms of bronze artifacts. So, in other words, they really instigated the beginning of the Bronze Age period. And all of these different peoples were coming together around the area of Stonehenge. So who was responsible for creating the Durrington shafts? Well, I suspect it was probably the Grooveware culture coming in from the north. There's evidence that they were creating huge engineering projects in other parts of the country. In Yorkshire, for instance, they cut this massive ditch into the earth that's around 100 feet deep and 100 feet wide, that goes for a distance of about 2.5 miles. And this is in the county of Yorkshire. And there is absolutely no functional reason why this monument was constructed. And it almost certainly had some kind of ritual or religious nature. And when I say religious, I don't necessarily mean, you know, some kind of formalized religion. What I mean by that is that these places have a symbolic function, one that relates not just to the calling of the ancestors or altered states of consciousness, but very possibly, and this is obviously something that will interest you and, of course, your listeners, is that these people almost certainly were aware of what we'd call today earthlights, light forms that existed at these various locations. And it can be shown, and this is something which I almost certainly will be doing in my upcoming book, which I'm writing with my colleague Greg Little, that all of the main locations where the grooveware culture can be found in Britain were also places where lights have been seen historically and continue to be seen and reported today as so-called UFOs.
That's the strangest thing because, you know, my wife and I associate the whole UFO phenomenon with the dead. And I know now, since she is part of the thing at this point in our life together, having been in that other world since 2015, that she was right to do that. And I think that there's something we just fundamental that we have lost track of about ourselves, that they knew. And that those were just, like Stonehenge was not just a place of empty ceremonial. It was a place where the dead and the living came into contact together. And very different ways that we can think of as possible now. Now, free dreamlanders, we'll get back to this whole extraordinary story in just a moment. Stay with us.
Unknown Country and Dreamland are unique in every way. The site offers over 16,000 news stories dating back 20 years, all of them with our uniquely open-minded and yet carefully researched point of view. You can find stories of everything from lost cities to multiple witness high strangeness events to the cutting edge of science and reality on the site. For subscribers, the site offers a wealth of material that is mind-opening and can be life-changing. Plus, there are active comment sections, both in the free area and the subscriber area, and a free weekly newsletter. Dreamland, which Whitley Strieber has been hosting for over 20 years, is archived on the site back to 2004. This archive is the only one of its kind in the world, an incredible richness of information that offers exciting adventure every time you dig in. So go to unknowncountry.com daily, get our newsletter, participate in the site's social groups, and above all, subscribe and join this unique community today. Go to unknowncountry.com and click on the subscribe tab to see our options. Earthfiles.com is Linda Moulton Howe's great website offering news of the edge of science and reality. Keep up with Linda's work every single day on earthfiles.com.
We're talking to Andrew Collins, his website, andrewcollins.com. You can also find him on Facebook. His latest book, Denisovian Origins, don't miss it with Greg Little. It's so cool. And subscribers, be sure and listen to the show of Denisovian Origins if you have not yet done so from last year and all of Andrew Collins' shows. Andrew, what is the purpose of the shafts? Do we have any idea as yet?
Well, we're working on it. I'm actually doing an article at the moment, which is to be published on ancient origins, trying to understand what exactly was going on at these sites. And I won't preempt anything at the moment because I need to actually get it down in writing. But the one thing I think that seems certain is that they are what we describe as functional. And I don't mean that in a practical sense. What I mean by that is that they were done for a reason, and that the reason had something to do with liminal concerns. In other words, communication with the other world, communication with what we call the dead, the ancestors, and that this would form part of complex rituals that would take place probably around the midwinter period, which, remember, is obviously the shortest day of the year. And I think that's crucial to remember that, because obviously as the year gradually gets older, the days get shorter. And there would have been a great concern amongst ancient communities that those days would continue to get shorter and shorter and shorter until eventually there was no light anymore, and that, you know, the end of the world would quite likely follow. So this was the reason that they did these huge ceremonies at the time of midwinter to actually call back the sun in many ways. I mean, it wasn't as easy as that. I mean, quite clearly, you know, they weren't necessarily sun worshippers, but what they were doing was ensuring the upcoming cycle of the year. And most probably the main celestial body that would have been involved with this would not have been the sun, actually, but the moon. The moon would have determined, you know, when they would have done certain rituals, when they would have started certain rituals, and when they would have finished them as well. So I believe that, you know, this was a major factor involved. Stars may also have been involved, although this is really speculation. But you can imagine a lot of activity going on, probably for several weeks before the midwinter period. You know, different preparations, you know, the gaining of the animals, the calling in of peoples from not just the southern part of Britain, but all over the world. Sorry, all over the country, I should say. Not all over the world. I don't suppose they came from everywhere. And, you know, they were doing something there, and that's what we're trying to understand. All I can say is that there is no practical reason why you would have dug these pits. They're too large. They certainly were not to hold anything like wooden posts or standing stones or anything like that, because they're just too big. Their shape is interesting, of course. You're talking about a cylinder, really, half a cylinder, if you want. And, you know, that suggests a functional practice, that there's something going on. Now, I mean, one suggestion, of course, is that they were used like the kivas of the Pueblo peoples of the southwest, North America, you know, that they would have been used for ritual activity. And perhaps, you know, that different clans, different tribes, different peoples would occupy one or more of the pits at a particular time, and that rituals would go on synchronous with each other. That is very possible, because, you know, even as unlikely or as fantasy as that seems, you know, we've got to find a good reason why they were dug. I mean, it wasn't, you know, it wasn't simply some kind of, you know, scheme to get people working. You know, there's something big going on here, and we have to take it in the context that, you know, within 10, 15 miles away, you've also got the Avebury landscape as well, where you've got massive stone circles, you know, several hundred yards across, with smaller stone circles inside them. You have Silbury Hill, the largest man-made mound in Europe, close by, and several other key monuments in that area. And that's just 10, 15 miles away.
The whole area is so magical and so incredible. I've been there in the past. I was there back in the 60s and when Stonehenge was sort of tourist attraction, but there were no car parks or anything. You had to just go there and stop on the roadside and walk in. And it was really a very, very magical, intensely alive place, just like Avebury was when Anne and I walked through it with you. It's obviously something very extraordinary and very, very special. Not to mention the crop circles, which are also in the area.
Well, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, obviously, the crop circles is a relatively modern phenomena. But, I mean, strange lights have definitely been seen in that area for at least 400 years. I'm going from reports that we know of. And if that's the case, the chances are they've been there for thousands of years and were certainly there when these Neolithic and later Bronze Age monuments were created. So therefore, we have to factor that these appearances of these strange lights into the existence and the presence of these monuments. So we have to say to ourselves, well, how did the ancient peoples interpret these lights? And I think you've already answered that question by the fact that they would have seen them as representations of the ancestors. I mean, up in Yorkshire, where the grooveware culture were also present, there is areas, particularly on a place called Ilkley Moor, where there are literally hundreds of rock carvings. And these rock carvings very often show concentric rings. These rings have got like ladders coming down from them. And you just look at them and they look like light being emitted from a central source. And you can't help but come to the conclusion that there is a possibility that they are something that's emitting light. Now, some people have interpreted them as stars, others as comets. But I think that there's a very real chance that they actually do depict, you know, earth lights, what we call UFOs today. And I mean, you know, again, I say this almost as if like this is a mad thing to say, but I am seriously coming to this conclusion. And I think probably, you know, once we know a bit more about these lights, how they are formed and how the ancients saw them. And remember that indigenous cultures all the way around the world saw these lights and interpreted them as different in different ways. Usually they were associated with the ancestors. Sometimes they were connected with what we call tricksters, you know, like these sort of spirits that play tricks and games on the land of the living. And at other times, they were probably seen as celestial beings or something to do with the stars, simply because they often look like stars themselves. So it looked as if a star had come to life and come down to Earth. So the connection between the light and the stars would have been born at that time. But for the most part, I believe that they would have seen these lights as emerging from either the ground or from lakes, bodies of water, from mountaintops, things like that. So they would have seen it as something emerging from an underworld environment. This seems to be the conclusions that I'm drawing from studying these various indigenous beliefs, which I'm looking at the moment, as I say, for this future book, which I'm writing with Greg Little.
Do you know yet when the new book is coming out or being finished?
It won't be for a while. I'm still writing at the moment, and so is Greg. Right.
What's the general subject? Can you tell us?
Well, yes. Yeah. I mean, basically, my part of the book starts in what is modern day Israel, with the discovery of a cave that is 400,000 years old. And in it, they found evidence of the earliest shamanism anywhere in the world. And amongst the evidence that's come to light is a swan wing bone that's been marked and modified that's very likely used in shamanic ceremonies. So here we have evidence of the first shaman in the world using the totem of the swan, quite clearly for astral flight, for soul flight. And this particular bird, as we know, will eventually become a very important soul bird amongst many cultures in Europe, in Asia, and even in North America. And I think that this is important because we can now trace back the origins of it. But, you know, what I'm doing is to try and get into the minds of the people 400,000 years ago to understand what they actually truly believed about what we call cosmology, ontology, animism, panpsychism, which is the idea that everything is alive and has spirit. I'm trying to understand that. And I've had long conversations with the archaeologists that are working at this particular cave, which is just outside of Tel Aviv. And so this starts the book. And obviously, you know, we come forward in time, particularly in the fact that in this very area, a number of the biblical stories were played out to do with Abraham and Jacob, for instance, you know, seeing the angels going up and down the ladder as he slept, creating a place which he thereafter named Bethel, the house of God. All this occurred just a few miles away from this particular cave. And, you know, you have to say to yourself, is there something special? Is there something important about not just this, but landscapes around the world that have attracted people and allowed themselves to create them, re-engineer them into ritual or ceremonial landscapes? You know, are lights involved in some manner? And I think the answer is yes. And if that's the case, then how did the ancients see these lights? How did they interpret them?
And I already know the answer is we don't yet know, but you are exploring this. That is, I do know that. And I think the next time Andrew comes on Dreamland, we're going to learn an awful lot more about mysteries like that, because the past remains totally unexplored. How could anyone spend 500 years building a single stone monument, or 1,000 years building Göbekli Tepe, and then 1,000 years burying it? The past is not the present. The people who lived then lived in a different reality. And when we talk about things like those lights, that reality comes closer to us. When we see the crop circles, it's that reality speaking to us from the deep past. There's a reason one of the visitors once told Betty Andreas and children of the northern people, you wander in eternal darkness. We're in the darkness now. But the past can lead us out and make us at last free to recover what we have lost of ourselves. They did not even have writing. How did they communicate? How did they ever do all of this stuff? Because this is an incredible, really beautifully constructed landscape that we couldn't really do today. So how? What was going on?
There was a different way of communication. I don't think it was necessarily psychic. I think it was more intuitive. But obviously the fact that they didn't have writing, which, you know, obviously has made me think just from you saying this, makes you think, well, how could they have created these incredible designs on the landscape, which seem to have geometrical patterns associated with them? And also, seemingly, they have lengths of measure that relate to celestial cycles and things like that, numbers that keep cropping up again and again. And you wonder how they achieve this. I mean, I suppose some people would say that it's all coincidence, or it was just luck that they achieved it. But I think it's far more than this. I mean, even if it's intuitively placing things and just getting it right, I don't know. But something else was going on, something that we've lost ourselves as a population.
And that's where we have to leave it right now. We've lost something of ourselves, something huge. They had it, whatever it was, and we need to find a way back to that, because maybe we need to find a new kind of civilization that can think in terms of 500 years and 1,000-year projects instead of just to the next corporate earnings quarter. I mean, come on, folks. We're right at the end of something here. We can do better. We can make something extraordinary out of this beautiful world of ours. Always remember the children. The future is all they have. Now, next up, we're going to be talking to David Halpern, my old friend. We have been friendly adversaries for a long time, and so you're going to have a lot of fun enjoying something that has become all too rare in this world. People who don't agree with each other, but who are still close friends. I remember when I was a boy, my father sent me up to Washington to meet the Texas senators, and I met Senator Ralph Yarborough, who was a real liberal, I mean, far more liberal than my dad was. But he welcomed me, and I had lunch in the Senate dining room with him and a friend of his, the Senator Everett Dirksen, very conservative, and they were such good friends and such clever adversaries. Our ability to get along together, even while disagreeing, isn't the greatest thing we've lost. There's magic that's lost from the human species. But one thing is true. We can certainly bring back that little corner of civility that has disappeared from our world. My way or the highway is simply not good enough. And now let's move on. We're going to spend some time with the commercials for Free Dreamlanders, and then we'll be back with David Halpern.
For all of Whitley's available books, visit the new UnknownCountry.com store. Just click on the store tab on Unknown Country's masthead, and you'll find a treasury of Whitley Strieber books, including classics like the Communion series, War Day and Majestic, and the eerily prophetic early novel Night Church, plus A New World, Afterlife Revolution, and all the latest. Visit the store now and join the adventure. In 2015, Whitley Strieber entered a whole new level of contact, and his new book, A New World, tells the powerful and revealing story of what's been happening. Read about contact experiences unlike you have ever heard described before. Learn about the breakthroughs in communication that are developing right now. Experience the wonder of seeing into a mirror universe. The thrill of discovering the close encounter experience in an entirely new way. And learn the secret of how Whitley has built a very real and ongoing relationship with our otherworldly visitors. One Amazon reviewer says, a significant document of human empowerment. Another, one mind-bending, reality-shifting read. Another, outstanding. Get A New World today, available as a paperback, a hardcover, and an ebook wherever books are sold. And as an audiobook read by Whitley on Audible.com.
What is the truth about UFOs? Or is there a truth, a final truth? Or something happening so complex and so strange that we can never come to the end of it, never to any final moment where we can say, this is what it is. Well, I have my take on it. Most of you have your take on it, and I think we're probably all pretty much in the same camp, maybe with some variations. David Halpern is not in our camp. He's been a friend of mine for a good while. Interesting, bright guy with a totally different take. On Dreamland, we talk about this in many, many different ways. Sometimes we talk about it as an alien encounter. Sometimes we talk about it on another level entirely, as something more spiritual or something having to do with other dimensions. And today, we're going to talk about it with David Halpern in a completely different way that's much closer to what I think Jacques Vallée thinks about this. And, of course, he sees it as an extension of the old fairy faith in his book, Passport to Magonia. David's got a very interesting take on it, though, that is different from Jacques in some pretty exciting and fascinating ways. David, I don't think you know him. He's not been on Dreamland before. He is in the department, taught in the Department of Religious Studies at the University of North Carolina in Chapel Hill, taught Judaic studies. He has, in the instance, we're going to be talking about a lot about this. He's published nonfiction on Jewish mysticism, and his novel, Journal of a UFO Investigator, as well. Now, his website is davidhalperin.net, David, H-A-L-P-E-R-I-N.net. His new book is Intimate Alien, The Hidden Story of the UFOs. And no, it's not a book about disclosure, is it, David, or about hidden documents or something like that? It's quite
no,
a different approach.
Not at all. Not so, at all, Whitley.
So tell us a little bit about your approach.
I see UFOs as a human phenomenon from beginning to end. I see them as visitors, not from outer space, but from inner space. From the depths of our souls, in which, to me, there's enough alienness to fill the universe.
in a sense, we're alone with this, is what you would say.
Yeah.
And we have always been alone with it.
Yeah. I do not know whether there is life somewhere out there in other solar systems or other galaxies. If there is, I do not believe it has anything to do with the UFO phenomenon. I think that the phenomenon is about us. It comes from us, and it expresses our longings and our terrors, particularly the greatest terror of all, the end of our existence.
And you feel that death is the absolute end, that this is what we have.
Yeah. Yeah. There are times that I don't believe that. I certainly wish it is not true, but deep in my gut, that's what I feel.
Now, you say there are times when you don't believe that. What are those times?
I think the times in which I consider that there does seem to be some evidence for reincarnation, the times that I consider that it is possible to see consciousness as a non-localized phenomenon. But then I keep coming back to the challenge of that ancient Roman Lucretius, who said, use the time before your birth as a mirror of the time after you die. What were you before you were born? Nothing. That's what you'll be after you die.
And that has been an argument for a long time. And I have to say that for most of my young life, not when I was a child, but by the time I reached my early teens and had forgotten all of the miraculous events of my childhood, I would have agreed with you entirely. And I would have agreed with you completely when the event that happened to me in the summer of the winter of 1985 happened. I say the summer accidentally because it actually started the summer before. I didn't acknowledge it. I would not acknowledge it. It took finally whatever it is, dragging me out by the hair and basically raping me in order for me to face that it was there. Now, what would have happened, I wonder, if you had had a similar experience? How would that have worked in your worldview?
I know I would have been a very different person from the person I've been. I remember that a few years ago, I wrote on my blog a review of the book that you and Jeff Kripal co-authored, The Supernatural. And I wrote that I feel at a disadvantage here, something like a lifelong virgin trying to understand sexual ecstasy. And I acknowledge that there is a limitation here, but this is who I am, and this is the only way I can proceed.
Now, you mentioned the word sexual ecstasy, which interests me a lot, because, of course, that's at the core, certainly, of my whole experience, dangerous sexual ecstasy, something like the fury of Kundalini. And this is... devastated my entire vision of reality. Everything. It fell, but my whole world collapsed. It imploded on itself on that night. It took a few days or a few weeks for me to realize that it had imploded, but it had. So you come to it now, though, from what to me is a very interesting perspective. Tell me, let's talk a little bit about some of the stories in your book, which are quite fascinating. I think I'd like to go kind of to the end of the page, to the shaver mystery. And can you tell us about that, what it was, because it's so seminal. This is something that happened in the 40s before the explosion of the UFO phenomena. And we're going to go from there, folks, on a different kind of a journey through the UFO phenomena with a man who has a different vision of it. So why don't you first set the scene by explaining what the shaver mystery was?
Okay, of the two words, shaver and mystery, the first word is the easier to explain. That Richard S. Shaver was a man who living in Bartow, Pennsylvania, who wrote a letter to Raymond Palmer in Chicago, the editor of Amazing Stories, a prominent and distinguished science fiction magazine, claiming to have discovered a key to all language in an ancient alphabet, in which each of the letters of the English language were given symbolic meanings, on the basis of which Shaver thought that he could decode the hidden meanings of English words. Shaver thought that English was not at all a recent development in the linguistic area, but rather something close to the mother lode of all languages, a language that Shaver called Mantong, which is clearly man plus tongue, the tongue of mankind. Shaver published his alphabet as a letter to the editor in Amazing Stories, and it created an enormous stir. Palmer later compared the mail that they received as in response to it, to the scene in Miracle on 34th Street. You remember that one in which people come into the courtroom carrying huge sacks of mail one after another? Whether it was quite that dramatic, I don't know. Raymond Palmer was given to self-dramatizing and to exaggerating. But there seems
no. Wait a minute. Let's back up again. Who exactly was Raymond Palmer? Oh, wait.
I'm sorry.
We have to stop. And we have to stop for a reason. The reason is it's time for free Dreamlanders to listen up. So listen to these commercials and then we'll be right back.
For all of Whitley's available books, visit the new UnknownCountry.com store. Just click on the Store tab on Unknown Country's masthead, and you'll find a treasury of Whitley Strieber books, including classics like the Communion series, War Day and Majestic, and the eerily prophetic early novel Night Church, plus A New World, Afterlife Revolution, and all the latest. Visit the store now and join the adventure. In 2015, Whitley Strieber entered a whole new level of contact, and his new book, A New World, tells the powerful and revealing story of what's been happening. Read about contact experiences unlike you have ever heard described before. Learn about the breakthroughs in communication that are developing right now. Experience the wonder of seeing into a mirror universe. The thrill of discovering the close encounter experience in an entirely new way. And learn the secret of how Whitley has built a very real and ongoing relationship with our otherworldly visitors. One Amazon reviewer says, a significant document of human empowerment. Another, one mind-bending, reality-shifting read. Another, outstanding. Get A New World today, available as a paperback, a hardcover, and an ebook wherever books are sold. And as an audiobook read by Whitley on Audible.com.
We're talking to David Halperin. His book, Intimate Alien, The Hidden Story of the UFO. His website, davidhalperin.com, that's with an I. And you hear all kinds of things on all kinds of shows, but the Dreamland is, I think, probably one of the few shows where someone who that covers this subject, where someone who does not agree that there is any external locomotion to it can even get a hearing. But you get a hearing here because I think, and I know my listeners will agree, that this is an absolutely fascinating viewpoint. Now, tell us a little bit more about Palmer.
Yes, I'm sorry. I thought I did introduce him by name.
You did. What I want to get at is that initially the letter that came to Amazing Stories was thrown into the trash by an editor.
Yes, and Palmer, this is at least the legend. And Palmer went diving after it because he saw something in it.
Now, did we know that Shaver actually existed as a human being?
Oh, I don't think anyone's questioned that.
Okay, so he was really a person. And was he connected to Palmer in some way?
Not prior to this.
But so what's worrying me, what bothers me is, why did Palmer suddenly decide to take something out of a trash can? He couldn't have done that every day.
I think this is linked with the special power of Palmer's personality. To understand Palmer, you have to know that he was a very beautiful child whose life was totally transformed as a result of a childhood encounter with a beer truck. He became deformed, became crippled. He was told twice in his youth that he was a goner, that he could not hope to live. And yet, through the power of his spirit, he was able to resurrect himself. I don't use that, mean that literally, to bring himself back from the state where the doctors despaired of him. Now, in the course, I mean, that being handicapped as he was, he missed a huge amount of school and instead had cartons of books brought to him from the Milwaukee Public Library. And there he taught himself history. He taught himself science. He taught himself mythology. He was your ultimate autodidact. And he was deeply skeptical of the scientific, the knowledge establishment. And Shaver seemed to present an alternative to the knowledge establishment.
Now, this was happening during World War II. It was in 1944.
So this horror
was unfolding in the world.
Yes. And the horror, yes.
Something was breaking down in the human psyche, I think.
And I think I've just begun to speak about what the Shaver mystery was about, because it didn't stay as a linguistic theory. Gradually, as Palmer and Shaver exchanged back and forth their letters and Palmer got to know Shaver better, he found that Shaver himself had direct experience with a world beneath our feet of which we're oblivious. And this world is the world of the underground caverns, that we are offspring of the race of what Shaver called the elder gods, who came to this earth, but eventually had to leave because the sun had turned poisonous. And they escaped on their spaceships to distant planets, leaving behind them two subterranean races who are related to us. One is called the Dero, who are perverted dwarfs with a strong sadistic bent who delight in kidnapping and torturing people from the surface. And the other is called Tero. That's the Dero is with a D and Tero is with a T. And the Tero are an almost human-like offshoot of the elder races who, although they're impoverished, have remained civilized and decent and who are in continued conflict with the Dero. Now, this image of a nightmare world beneath our feet seems to me clearly a mirror of the world that was being revealed in the late 1940s as the Allies stumbled across Hitler's Dero-esque death camps, and then finally the war ended in the ultimate horror, which affected Palmer profoundly, of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. All of this seems to me to have contributed to make Shaver's story a powerful one. Now, what is the mystery in the story? This is the first question that I asked in my chapter on the Shaver mystery. Since you might think of this as a myth to inspire or perhaps terrify, what was it about it that made it a mystery? And this, the name was given to it by Palmer, and it plugs into his idea that mystery is it's not a riddle to be solved, but a state of mind in which the human spirit reaches its fullest potential, the awareness that we are surrounded by mystery. And for Palmer, Shaver had given us that awareness. That was why he believed Shaver. That was why he promoted Shaver. That was why, even when he discovered that the time that Shaver said he had been under in the caverns, that he had in fact mostly been in a mental hospital, to Palmer, that didn't discredit Shaver's story at all, because what Shaver was telling about was truths from deep inside him.
And I think we are aware of that in a sense. Let me tell you a story, and because of course my entire life has a curious echo of all of this stuff in it, and here's what I mean. One day we were in our cabin in upstate New York, which had a private road, and we were discussing with one of our neighbors some work that needed to be done on the road. He and I and Ann were sitting in the living room together doing this, and we had noticed, Ann and I, for the previous couple of days, a high-pitched whining sound coming from underneath the cabin. It sounded like some kind of high-speed drill. And the cabin sat on an enormous seam of iron, and 30 miles to the north, there was the Iron Mountain facility which had been drilled out in that huge iron seam in order to make storage, and still there for that matter. But in any case, we had at that point in our lives noticed that the visitors, as we call them, especially the dark blue dwarf-like ones, would come up from below, and you could smell the forest floor on them as if they'd come up through the dirt. In any case, we were sitting there talking, and this drilling noise kept coming up from below. And it was the sort of noise that would make your teeth hurt. It was not a pleasant noise. And suddenly, the man we were having the meeting with, stream of blood came out of the center of his forehead and shot out into the room like a something out of a water gun. and Anne leaped up and grabbed Kleenex and started staunching the blood. And he went home never to return, as you may imagine. Later that day, we were going to take a little friend of our son's home, and we stopped by a neighbor's house to see some butterflies, because he was interested in butterflies, and they had a deck overlooking a little draw that was always full of butterflies. So he was there looking at the butterflies. As we walked in, the wife said, "I found the cat." But then we saw, and she saw, lying mysteriously dead on the deck, a black, big black Labrador retriever, which was just a complete mystery, at least to us, although they may have been their dog. Things happened so fast at that point, I don't really know. The boy then went into the living room and was looking out over the draw when suddenly he whirled around. I realized that blood came pouring out of both of his nostrils, not just dripping out, but gushing out like it had out of the head of the man. And he was also wearing a cap that said cat on it. And we were just shocked to core. We called the family of the boy. He'd never had a nosebleed before in his life, as they understood it. So, you know, we packed up and went home, and held the boy with his head back and got the nosebleed controlled fairly easily. And then we took him home. Now that has something to do with the underground. What do you think? How does that work in relation to your explanation of the, of Shaver's stories of the underground, which I would agree seem entirely absurd. No, I couldn't agree with you more. They do.
But then, I don't
mine
say
do
that.
Too, and yet mine actually happened.
I didn't say they were absurd, Whitney, and it's a very important point. I think they did not happen in the physical world. I don't think they're at all absurd. I think they have to be translated into psychological terms, which is the essential thrust of my book. Not to psychopathologize Shaver. Lord knows that enough people did.
Well, of course they did. I mean, look at his stories.
Not to mention that he was in a mental hospital for 10 years.
Right, that's my point.
But suppose we say that he is speaking of something that is within him, that the Darrow is a part of him, a part of Palmer, a part of you and me, that he was able to make concrete in a very vivid way. I mean, I'll give you a specific story that I mentioned in the book that it seems to me to clarify this, that when Palmer heard the news of Hiroshima, he understood at once what it meant. This was an extremely intelligent man. And he said that Shaver's underworld, imaginary or not, has burst forth upon us. What strange guidance might our scientists have had that he knew that literally the underground caverns and the Darrow didn't exist, but he understood that taken symbolically, they revealed a horrifying truth about our world that had been displayed by the Nazis and now was displayed by us in this apocalyptic weapon that we had used. So no, I don't think Shaver was absurd at all.
Well, that's a really fascinating response, and not one I expected. And I'm digesting it. While I digest it, Free Dreamlanders, I have some really bad news. The bad news is that our hour together is over, and we are going to go on with the subscribers for, gosh, nearly another hour of exploring this topic with David Halpern in, quite frankly, a new and, I think, absolutely fascinating way. He does not agree with us. Most of us doesn't agree with me for the most part. But what a great and effective argument he has for the true level of mystery that we're facing. Thank you so much for being with us on Dreamland. We'll see you again next week.
You've been listening to Dreamland. Be sure to tune in again next week. Dreamland is brought to you by UnknownCountry.com and its family of subscribers. Unknown Country was founded by Ann Streber. Our news editor is Matthew Frizzell. Our coordinator is Amy Safrankova. Whitley Streber is your Dreamland host. And I'm your announcer, Ted Alexander. Thank you for listening.